asked Joshu, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? Zen students have grappled with the seeming dichotomy of Buddha nature and human nature. The koan makes the juxtaposition even more extreme by talking about canine nature rather than human nature. But it's clear that what's being set up is an opposition between something called Buddha nature, and we don't really know what the young monk had in mind when he asks about Buddha nature, but probably something very exalted, ideal, the epitome of perfection, of liberation. Liberation from what? Well, the dog seems to represent the world of our animal nature, the body, its appetites, desires, attachments, but also its limitations. It's subject to sickness, old age, and ultimately death. Whereas perhaps Buddha nature connects us to just the opposite, something spiritual rather than physical, immaterial rather than material, perhaps even immortal rather than mortal. The monk's question is important not as a philosophical abstraction, but because it illustrates a fundamental split that I think we all feel within ourselves. It becomes part of what we try to work out in practice. The most basic level, we need to ask, what do we mean by a word like Buddha nature? What do we mean by a word like spirituality? What is it that we are endeavoring to become? Where is it that we imagine we're stuck? What are we trying to escape? Now, throughout history, both East and West, spirituality has been identified with the cultivation of or the pursuit of the spirit as opposed to the body, attempting to get us in contact with either something higher than ourselves, something divine, or to seek within ourselves some spark of that divinity, perhaps associated with our mind rather than our body, our awareness rather than our thoughts or feelings. In fact, I think for most people, the whole notion of spirituality, implies that attempt to connect with something higher, transcendent, something other than the world of our physical bodies, our mortality, our thoughts, our feelings, and so forth. When I started thinking about this retreat with Max and how I would begin to talk about this issue of the identity of Buddha nature and human nature, I happened to come across something that I thought epitomized what spiritual practice seems to be for most people. This I'm going to read this, and it just happens to be by Ken Wilber, but I think it could easily come from many traditions, some Theravada Buddhist or Hindu. I'm just trying to adjust the lighting here a little bit so I can read this. So listen to these instructions. These are basically meditation instructions. And see how they sound to you. I have a body, but I am not my body. I can see and feel my body. And what can be seen and felt is not the true seer. My body may be tired or excited, sick or healthy, heavy or light, but that has nothing to do with my inward I. I have a body, but I am not my body. I have desires, but I am not my desires. I can know my desires, and what can be known is not the true knower. Desires come and go, floating through my awareness, but they do not affect my inward I. I have desires, but I am not my desires. I have emotions, but I am not my emotions. I can feel and sense my emotions, and what can be felt and sensed is not the true feeler. Emotions pass through me, but they do not affect my inward I. I have emotions, but I am not my emotions. I have thoughts, but I am not my thoughts. I can know and intuit my thoughts, and what can be known is not the true knower. Thoughts come to me and thoughts leave me, but they do not affect my inward I. I have thoughts, but I am not my thoughts. I am what remains, a pure center of awareness, an unmoved witness of all these thoughts, emotions, feelings, and desires. Now, I dare say that the idea of the cultivation of a pure center of awareness, something that exists independently of the body, independently of thought, feeling, desire, that is has no content, is in some sense imperturbable, perhaps even connects us to something outside ourselves that's divine, perhaps even immortal. I think this would pass for a lot of people's notions of what spiritual practice is all about. Ken Wilber calls this higher consciousness level 2, the transpersonal witness exercise. And I think the whole notion, again, of the cultivation of something we'll designate as a higher consciousness, some special state, is what people think of when they talk about spirituality. Now, in response to that exercise, I wrote one of my own. See how this sounds in comparison. I am my body, a living, breathing body, with all its physical sensations of comfort and discomfort, relaxation and tension, changing each moment with each inhalation and exhalation, dependent on each moment on the air I breathe and the environment which sustains my life. I am my desires, my appetites, my need for love and attachment, my ambitions and ideals. In each moment, I may experience satisfaction or lack, fullness or emptiness, learning gradually to distinguish my needs from my wants, the conditions for my flourishing from the fleeting effects of gratification. I am my emotions, my love and my anger, my sadness and my joy, my calmness and anxiety, moment after moment, reflecting my inescapable dependence on others, my vulnerability to the vicissitudes of their attention. I am my thoughts, which pass through my awareness moment after moment, like clouds through the sky, sometimes peacefully, sometimes not. Whatever their content, I can recognize them as thoughts, part of the ongoing flow of my consciousness, a necessary part of what feels like me, to be neither banished nor suppressed, but acknowledged in their passing. I am my intention to practice the values and ideals of the Buddha way, which are not of my own creation, but are passed down to me through generations of students and teachers on whom I depend for the forms and discipline and understanding that makes practice possible. I am simultaneously the product of that long tradition, its manifestation in the present, and its shaper for the future. I am a whole person whose body, desires, emotions, thoughts, intentions, and awareness are all inseparable from my Buddha nature, all continually manifesting their inherent interdependence, impermanence, and perfection, just as they are right here and right now. I hope you will grant that whatever you think of those two versions, they represent two very distinct approaches to whatever it is that we call spiritual. And in a way, part of what we're going to try to discuss this weekend is whether the whole second approach even deserves to be called spiritual or not. We might be asking questions something like, can we have spirituality without a spirit, without entering into a dualism of mind and body, or soul and body, or consciousness, awareness, and the body? Does spirituality necessarily involve that kind of split? Now, the texts that I selected for readings for this weekend from Martin Haglund's book, This Life, try to define what he calls a secular faith. He's not a Buddhist, and in fact, he has some quite critical things to say about Buddhism. And we're going to try to address those as well tomorrow. But what he does have in his definition of secular faith, an emphasis on two aspects of our existence, namely our mortality, our finitude, as he would say, and our interdependence. And the theme that will run through his book is that there's something that we can call spiritual freedom that is dependent on, and in fact defined by, that very finitude and that very interdependence. He wants to make a contrast between an emphasis on those things and a spirituality that looks beyond this world to another, either to an afterlife or to a creator or just to another realm, anything that counts as sort of a higher realm. And what made the book attractive to me for our purposes is that the two factors that he singles out, finitude and interdependence, we might say impermanence and interconnectedness, just happen to be one definition of Buddha nature. Because that is how that young monk's question to old Joshu ultimately is going to have to be resolved. It's going to be the recognition of Buddha nature in the midst of this body, this life, in the midst of our impermanence, in the midst of our mortality, the midst of our vulnerability and our dependence on others. It's a basic fact that for most of us, at some psychological level, that's exactly the opposite of what really brings us to practice. We look for escape from our vulnerability. We are looking for some alternative to our dependence on others. We look for some hope for a life after death. We look for something in ourselves that will be imperturbable, immune to the vicissitudes of life. And so much of what we do in our practice, consciously or unconsciously, is to try to seek out the kind of unmoved, immaterial knower that Ken Wilber writes about. A pure awareness, a disembodied I, that is not reducible to thought, feeling, desire, or anything to do with the body. One might say that the opposite of Buddha nature as impermanence and interconnection is the fantasy of Buddha nature as autonomy and imperturbability or invulnerability. Autonomy is something self-contained, impervious, and invulnerable, and either within itself or through connection to something higher and divine. And it will when it comes right down to it, that's the version of Buddha nature most of us were hoping for. And I'm afraid I'm going to deliver up to you its opposite this weekend. The Buddha nature that's all about our impermanence and our vulnerability. Not necessarily what we hope for at all. See, I think that even within our Zen practice, that deep underlying curative fantasy of autonomy and imperturbability is always at work. I think that functions for us in the background, whether we believe it or not. And I'm hoping that through a close reading of some of these passages of Haglund, we can critique our own practice of Buddhism from the outside and see to what extent we get entangled in these alternate versions of Buddha nature and what it takes to bring us back to the one that is simply about our mortality, our vulnerability, not our escape from these, but to see them as the very embodiment of who and what we are. I hope you'll have a chance to do those readings, and I will try to outline some of the main points there in my talk tomorrow morning. Max, I think, will address in particular his critique of Buddhism in his afternoon talk, and that will form the basis of our discussion groups in the morning and the afternoon. Looking forward to that.